Demonstrators raising their voices in unison. At dusk at the state capitol Tuesday, dozens of protests across Wisconsin this week. We're taking stock of what it's like to cover the Black Lives Matter movement on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you been out on the streets? Where did you go to protest? Are you an organizer? What is it like for you to gather voices? We're at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's covered public safety, crime, and policing in Milwaukee since 2013. Ashley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So for 7 days now, protesters in Milwaukee marching the streets, demanding justice for George Floyd, demanding justice for Joel Acevedo, who died from injuries following a fight with an off-duty police officer who was later charged. Give us some of your reflections on what you see happening now in Milwaukee.
I think what you see happening in Milwaukee and around the country is a broad movement that is moving beyond issues of policing and really getting at the heart of, you know, of civil rights and of addressing, you know, systemic racism embedded within American society. I think you're hearing a lot more calls, not just for police reform, but, you know, really rethinking American institutions around equity.
So you're seeing a growing movement going broader than police brutality.
Yes, although that remains the focus, and that is certainly what prompted this most recent wave of national demonstrations, from what I'm hearing from people involved, as well as people who have been involved with these kinds of movements before, is that it really seems to be broader, more encompassing. It's certainly drawing many more people to the streets and a much more diverse crowd. You're seeing people of all different ages, all different races, who are taking to the streets and demonstrating.
Milwaukee being a very segregated city, it has seen protests and riots before. Can you give us some of that historical context?
Absolutely. I think most recently in 2016, there were several nights of unrest in the city's Sherman Park neighborhood after the police shooting of Seville Smith. And that was an event that, in one respect, ended, it was a very different outcome because the police officer involved with that ended up being charged with homicide. That was only the second time in modern history in Milwaukee that that had happened. The officer ultimately was acquitted, but the case did go to a jury. I think a key part within that case was the use of body camera that was cited by the prosecutor to bring those charges. The fact that Milwaukee police patrol officers have all had body cameras since 2016 as a result of earlier protests. So before that, there was the fatal shooting of Dontre Hamilton in Red Arrow Park. And before that, there, you know, was the in-custody death of Derek Williams, who died in the back of a squad car saying, you know, he couldn't breathe. And I think you can go even farther back to the death of Ernest Lacey. And so people have been protesting these injustices in Milwaukee for a very long time. And those, each of those movements have led to some sort of change or reform in policy or public perception. And I think this is just continuing on that progression, on that path.
We're talking with Ashley Lutheran, covers public safety, crime, and policing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. What questions do you have about the protests in Milwaukee? Do you think the most recent marches in Milwaukee and around the state will lead to broader change? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ashley, do you think body cameras have made a difference?
I think it's important to look at the research and the studies that we've had. I think the use of video across the country, capturing police encounters regardless, but specifically police encounters with African American residents, has really led to this broader understanding of how we're seeing interactions that we all didn't see before, that weren't kind of broadcast, and maybe things that were, you know, really well known in one local city weren't traveling as fast to other cities because you didn't have that use of video. And so I think it's not just about body cameras, but everyone has a camera and can take video from their cell phones. And that's what you're really seeing, whether it's cases involving the police or cases involving, you know, harassment. You know, a lot of people are also, you know, connecting all of this to what happened in Central Park, as well as I understand you were talking about the earlier case. And so it's just, I think video is really, really providing evidence to something that it is really providing a perspective, a broad perspective to something that people and communities of color have been telling all of us, particularly white communities, for a long time had been happening.
Let's bring in a call now. Stephanie is joining us from Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there. I wanted to make one statement and ask a question. The first statement I want to make is that I really wish we would refer to these murders, killings, as lynching. And then my question is, I haven't heard, and I've listened to a lot of news, I haven't heard about the man who was denied water in Milwaukee's prison, or not prison, sorry, in the jail, and how he tragically died. And that was just cruelty, just as well as standing on someone's neck for 9 minutes. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks for the call. Ashley, can you respond there?
Yes. So I believe the caller was referring to the death of Terrell Thomas, and he died of dehydration in the jail, in the Milwaukee County Jail. That has led to an ongoing criminal case and civil case as well. And I apologize, I have not checked on that specific case most recently, so I don't have the most recent information, but I do recall that Armour Correctional, which was the healthcare provider contracted to be in the jail, was actually criminally charged in that death.
When you look at the protests over the past 7 days, how do you see them organized and coming together?
It's been really interesting to watch, because you are seeing protests all over the city. I was talking with a few protest organizers earlier in the week, and there was even confusion about, wait, so there's something on 76th and something on Humboldt, and let's, you know, they're talking like, let's regroup here. So you're seeing Facebook events, people having solidarity events, people of different faiths coming together and having their own events. And so it's really just a series of sort of organic and some planned, but it seems like a lot of organic marches and protests happening across the city, at least here in Milwaukee. And they're really spanning many, many miles over many hours.
What about community leaders, civic leaders? What have you heard from them?
I think a lot of civic leaders are wondering and really thinking, how will this moment lead to lasting change? How can this be harnessed for something different? You've seen a lot of government agencies as well as civic institutions like large foundations in the city talking more bluntly about racism as a public health issue, the fundamental need to address racism that's embedded within a lot of systems, and how do you make those institutions and those organizations more equitable and therefore, you know, more effective for the communities they're working with and they're in, and ultimately trying to help. And so that seems to be the real question, is, you know, what can be done to make sure that this leads to lasting change. And I think, as Reggie Moore, who's the director of the city's Office of Violence Prevention, put it, you know, none of this is happening in a vacuum. You know, this is all accumulative demonstrations and protests, and that's ultimately what's going to keep happening in order to build off this movement.
Ashley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kent.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Lutheran covering protests in Milwaukee. We'll be back in a minute right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Dozens of protests across Wisconsin this week in communities big and small. There's miles of walking with call and response chants, and then the documenting.
Hey, everybody. I'm here in downtown Appleton with one of today's three organized protests.
That is Rachel Hotmire of WGBA-TV in Green Bay, following marchers as journalists have been doing across the state. We're taking stock of these protests in the context of history. Did you participate in the 1967 Milwaukee race riot? Were you in Sherman Park after the police shooting of Sylville Smith in 2016? How do you compare now and then? Let's reflect. 800-642-1234. Pamela Oliver is Professor Emerita of Sociology at UW-Madison, where she studies protest movements and racial disparities in criminal justice. Pam, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
All right. So I know you've been following these protests very closely as a sociologist. What are you seeing and what are you reflecting on?
Well, I'm sitting here in isolation, so I'm not out on the streets, which is kind of hard to really get it. It's all disconnected, but I can get the sense that there's so many people out on the streets right now. All around the country, there's obviously widespread protest in big cities, small towns. I'm seeing a lot of police aggressiveness in some cities, some places against the protesters. And I'm seeing a lot of discussion and debate, especially at the beginning of the protests, about exactly who was out there and who was doing what. And then as the protests continue, they are taking on more and more, as far as I can tell, more and more the character of what you would expect in a protest where it's a lot of people excited to be out there to demonstrate their support for the issue.
We're also seeing this spread around the globe, Hong Kong, Canada, Israel, Brazil, protests happening over the world now. Why do you see the spread?
Well, again, it's I'm not sure I have a good answer for it, except that I am seeing it.
Yeah.
I think that it's getting lots of publicity and there's it's the issues are very important. And at a certain point, as things start spreading, then they tend to spread more and people get interested in the issue. I think it's also so within the context of the United States, it's a very important and ongoing issue. I suspect that some of the way it's spreading right now has to do in part because we all around the globe, or at least in people have been in lockdown for so long. And so as people are kind of all simultaneously coming somewhat out of lockdown and into the protest in one giant wave, I think that may be part of what's happening. So it's kind of a focus of attention.
We're talking with Pam Oliver, Professor Emerita of Sociology at UW-Madison. She studies social movements. How do you feel about the officers involved in George Floyd's death facing charges for murder? What was your reaction? Do you think this will offer Floyd and his family justice? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Rory is with us from Racine. Hi, Rory.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. What's on your mind? Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate the professor's perspective. I think she's got it right with this people being locked down. So there's a lot of people out there. They're protesting. That's all good. But I don't think it's all just about Mr. Floyd. I think it's about just the social injustice overall. I back the badge. I see police officers putting their lives on the line. Did this guy do a bad job? Absolutely. But I want to ask the professor why people have swept under the carpet the fact that we've got a community center in other community centers in Racine that was burnt down here in Racine by gangsters and thugs, and nobody wants to talk about it.
Rory, thank you. Yeah, thank you for the call. Pam Oliver, what about the torching, the looting, the vandalism? What place does that have in these protests?
So I guess what I can bring to the table in this discussion is not so much what's actually happened in any given time, you know, any given event right now today. What I can tell you is I've studied these kinds of protests as they've happened in the United States for the last 30 years. That's what my research is about, is past protests and news coverage of those protests. And one of the things that we know is there's a tendency for the media and some parts of the general white public to focus on the incidents of arson and burning. And it becomes a way of turning attention away from the grievances about police aggressiveness and police violence and differential policing. And so that narrative arc that you have an incident of injustice that it gets a lot of attention. And then over time, the media discussion and the white discussion turns towards why were the protesters violent? And the attention to what the officers did dissipates across a long criminal justice process in which most of the time, 2 years later, by the time it's all wound down, the officers have not actually been punished all that much, even if they were initially charged.
So the focus gets diluted.
The focus gets shifted. Yes, that's what tends to happen in the narrative is, yes, that was very unjust. I can see that was unjust, but wait a minute. Why arson and looting? Or even, wait a minute, why are you blocking freeways? Or even, wait a minute, why is it hard for me to go downtown? I mean, I know this is a just issue, but this protest is getting in my way. So that's a very common dynamic in the narrative that we see over and over and over again. And that is the kind of thing that we sociologists actually study.
So when you look at the charges this week brought by Minnesota's attorney Keith Ellison, the former officers involved in George Floyd's killing will face charges. What does that mean for the movement?
Well, the movement is using the Floyd killing. It's the spark that started this round of protests. But the underlying issues of how are people policed in the United States, why is so much money going into policing and social control instead of social services, the racial differences in the racial hierarchies, those are longstanding issues. And so the movements are really prepared to address the longstanding systemic issues that they see with the particular incident of the Floyd incident being a very galvanizing, terrible incident that attracted people's attention. But for the movement, it's not just about that one incident. It's about the largest, it's also about that one horrible incident, but it's about the larger systems. And one of the things that I've seen in a wide variety of these major incidents is if there's enough protests, the officers get charged, but then it's like a year before the trial. Sometimes they're found not guilty. Sometimes they're found guilty of a lesser charge. The sentence ends up being very light, or they appeal. And as the entire situation winds out across the years, what people's complaint is that even in egregious cases, the officers very rarely are actually disciplined for the action.
And the momentum that created that spark and the subsequent demonstrations, it doesn't carry over until the verdict, perhaps, or people forget?
So the white public and the media forget. So you do. I mean, you can't. A protest, it's actually physically impossible for protesters to stay in the streets for 6 months or a year. I mean, people do have to go to their jobs and eat and live. And so protests tend to be episodic. What's kind of unusual in this case is that everybody's out at once. But if you think about it, in many ways, in terms of the issues that we're discussing, the movement is discussing, we're picking up where we left off in 2016. We're really having exactly the same conversation as we were having in 2016. All that happened is when Donald Trump, to people's surprise, won the presidential election, then attention turned over to all of the different issues that started coming out of the new administration, immigration and the tax bills and so forth and so forth. But every single thing that people are saying in the protests and the movements right now, they were saying in 2016. It really is a continuous movement.
Okay, so you can draw a lot of parallels, and it's picking up from where you see it left off.
That's what I think. And actually, if you remember, it didn't actually stop. There were the Colin Kaepernick protests, the Take a Knee protests were going on. It it didn't stop. It's the same movement. It's just there are episodes of contention, what we call episodes of contention, but there's these episodes of massive protests that occur. But the underlying issue, and many of the organizations concerned about the issue, many of the people concerned about the issue, are continuous and ongoing. The street crowds come and go, but the organizers, the activists, the people working on the issue have been there all along.
UW-Madison sociologist Pam Oliver stays with us. She studies protest movements, racial disparities, and criminal justice over time. How do you feel about the officers involved in George Floyd's death facing charges for murder? What is your reaction? Do you think this will offer Floyd and his family justice? Do you think protests will bring change this time? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Pam Oliver right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Quick programming note here. Join us tonight at 7 for an hour-long special broadcast of Here and Now from our partners at PBS Wisconsin. It's a conversation about race, and host Frederica Freiberg leads a discussion exploring issues of race, social justice, policing, and connected events here in Wisconsin and around the country. That is tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Walk with us! Walk with us! Walk with us!
We're looking at protest movements through time. That is marchers in Milwaukee earlier this week. What legacy will these marches leave? What change will come about? How do you think we will remember this time? Are you thinking back to protests in your youth? Share your flashbacks with us, 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison sociology professor Pam Oliver, who studies protest movements and racial disparities in criminal justice, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Lou is joining us from Ashland this morning. Hi, Lou.
Hey, good morning. Real quick, I want to give your guest time to comment on this, but qualified immunity. I heard this yesterday, and I was trying to figure out how I could help, what I could do, how I could approach Washington, and that, I think, is where we need to start, because it seems that the police are hiding behind qualified immunity. When they react and they do more than what they should do, I would like to know, you know, how your guest feels about that. And I think we all need to take that to Washington and get things changed.
Lou, thank you. Pam, go ahead.
So certainly the legal status of police is one of the problems. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't recite the decisions for you. But in general, there have been decisions as high as the United States Supreme Court that have said that police officers can act in ways. One of the issues is they can act in ways based on their subjective sense of fear, even if that subjective sense of fear is not grounded in fact. And there's also just wide qualified immunity for their actions. And that is actually one of the serious problems in the United States is the legal status of police officers and the way in which they are buffered by both in many places, union contracts in many states. There's variations across states in exactly what the laws are. But this problem that people cannot be held accountable for their actions is one of the serious problems. The logic of this comes from the military, in which military personnel commit acts that are crimes if ordinary people do them. They kill people. And so there's an idea of chain of command, and that if you're following lawful orders in the military, then you can kill people and not be a murderer. And what's happening is the police are trying to sort of get under that cover of military, except the public is not the enemy. The police are supposed to be protecting the general public, not attacking the general public. But that is the area in which all these immunity laws are coming from. And that is one of the very serious problems in the United States about policing.
Does it get more complicated when the National Guard is called in?
Oh, Lord. So I don't actually even know what the legal status of the National Guard is, but I assume it's more like a military logic.
Okay.
So it, it is a problem when you have the police acting as if the general public is the enemy. That is precisely the problem. There's a different, and that issue is at the core of a lot of what the protesters are talking about. When they really, I mean, there's some protesters who are simply saying, reacting to the one incident, of course, but as protesters understand the issue and dig into the larger structures of these issues, that is where they go. And one of the issues absolutely is the immunity and the broader context within which United States policing operates.
When we're seeing protesters face to face with police in riot gear, there's been some overarching pressure from protesters to see these police take a knee. What is that image like to you and to protest through time if a police officer does take a knee for a moment?
So let me see if I can do this briefly. The protester police interactions are crucial in what happens in a protest. And there's a substantial literature on how violence in protest often happens with police aggressiveness. Most often in a protest, if it turns violent, the police started it in a way. And so these tense interactions between police and protesters are really crucial. And there's a lot of policing theory about how to handle crowds. And these de-escalation moves are considered one of the ways to calm tensions down. So that's one thing to say. And there's the symbolic actions. I've seen a great deal of debate about these kneeling issues. So many protesters, and again, keep in mind, I'm not out on the streets. I'm sitting at home looking at social media, and I'm very aware it's a very filtered experience. Many people are complaining about the superficiality and empty gesturing of police taking a knee. Feeling that that has nothing to do with the larger structural issues of policing. At the same time, the taking the knee is a gesture in that interactional moment, at least, of trying to acknowledge the legitimacy of the protest and sort of de-escalate the confrontation of that particular situation. And there's also, I mean, there are certainly many police, most police, issued statements that the specific act that happened in Minneapolis that killed George Floyd, they repudiated. So you get from, was this specific action legitimate, to the broader issues of policing in general. But I do see that the taking the knee is it's a meaningful gesture in one way, and in another way, it's a police tactic. It's a de-escalation gesture. And I'm actually in favor of de-escalation, if you ask my opinion, but they are these dynamics of what's going on in a protest.
Pam Oliver with us, Emerita Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison. Your thoughts as well. How do you think police and community relations can be improved in your area? When you watch these protests, what needs to be done to make sure people feel safe and heard by officers? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Katrina now, joining us from Grand Chute this morning. Hi, Katrina.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a grandson who just graduated from high school, and his goal and dream in life is to become a police officer. My personal family, we grew up on the poverty line, and we know, I think, we felt a lot of the same discrimination that the colored people have known. And I just, I am just pleading and hoping that they will train and teach the police how to deal with this.
Katrina, I want to stop right here. Pam Oliver, I want to jump in here in terms of what the younger generation would think about in even going into this profession, policing.
Whoa. So there's so many layers. So obviously there's some protesters who are who want there to be just a lot fewer police and a lot less policing. There's also very different ways of doing policing. So other countries have police who are not necessarily so confrontational and aggressive with their populations. And so the debates about the real debates as you get into these issues are about not whether the police are good or bad human beings specifically, but about the structure of policing, the legal status of policing. The United States police have been going in the direction of militarization, and that creates a certain kind of way of policing. And that's, you know, do the police have to carry guns? Do the police have to respond aggressively to the population? Are the police trained in de-escalation tactics? What is their relationship to the community that they police? Those are really the issues that are happening. And one of the things I heard in a conversation with online with some of the local activists here was making the point that for many African-American communities, the police are operating more like an occupying army, not like a member of the community. And I think if you think about that as whether you think of the police as a member of the community who's helping to maintain order in collaboration with the community, that's a different model of policing than a police officer who sees the community as the enemy.
And do we see that? Do we see that in our communities here in Wisconsin, where there is that collaboration, or is it hit and miss? Is there not one model out there in policing in our state?
That is what's going on. Is there's a lot of research that says predominantly white suburban communities, and actually even predominantly white urban communities, experience the police as a very different kind of policing than predominantly Black and Latinx communities experience. So not everybody is having the same kind of relationships with the police. And there's a great deal of research that both from looking at how police departments actually behave and at looking at the subjective experiences of citizens with the police, there's a huge divide in how people actually experience police around them. And I think that's part of the big problem when we try to talk about the police, is the police that I experience in my predominantly white part of town is a different experience of the police than other people have in other parts of the city.
UW-Madison sociologist Pam Oliver, our guide to the context of demonstrating against police violence, institutional racism. When you hear the chants, what do they cause you to think about? How do the protests make you feel? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Pam Oliver here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Businesses are starting to display yellow signs in their windows with these words, "Local Black-owned business. We are in this together. Hashtag justice for George." Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting these signs came from the historic King Drive Business Improvement District. What do you think about destruction, looting of property? Are you a police officer? How do you think police and community relations can be improved in your area, on your beat? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison sociologist Pam Oliver staying with us. Let's take another call now. Jim is joining us from Freedom this morning. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I personally think we should have police officers of the same nationality serving in areas of one race instead of having white police officers live in the nice neighborhoods trying to police people they don't even know. And that's another thing I think also should be required, that they live in neighborhoods that they serve so they really know the people. Because the more you know people, the easier it is to relate to them and talk to them, and you have better results. Right now, even out of Gamey County, most of the police officers live in the nice neighborhoods, and they have no relationship with the people that live in the rougher neighborhoods of out of Gamey County. And it should be a requirement. A new police officer comes in, he has to live in a certain neighborhood and serve. And then he'll get to know the people respect him better, and it worked better, I think. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Jim, thanks. Pam Oliver, officers being a reflection of your community and living in it.
So that's a common point of discussion. And it, let me see if I can give. So first of all, that the idea that the police should be of the community. And I think it's perhaps helpful to distinguish a couple of dimensions. One is, who are the police accountable to? Are they accountable to the residents in the community where they're policing? Are they accountable to some other group outside where they're policing? So I think that's one issue to pay attention to. And another issue, there's been a lot of discussion, especially since the 1960s. Police departments have become much more diverse. It is more likely that the police officers, especially in large cities, are racial minorities. It varies a lot. In some cases, the race of the officer doing the policing actually doesn't make that much of a difference. It's really the structure of the relationship of the police department to the community that's often important. But I both agree that having the police officers be of the community is one of the issues that is discussed a lot. But I'm just trying to say that it's really of the community and accountable to the community that activists are talking about, not just what race you are.
Steve from Sun Prairie asked on the similar vein, wanted to know if researchers have looked at how often police violence occurs against Black Americans compared to the number of police encounters with Black Americans.
There has been research on that, yes. It is an area in which there's some debate among academics about what's the correct thing to control for when you do the statistical models. In general, Black Americans have many more encounters with police. So that's the first thing to say. And if you control with encounters, so it's like, should you control away the encounters with police? But in general, the research finds Black Americans have many more encounters with police. And a lot of that has to do with how police are assigned to neighborhoods, how police work. Then Black Americans are much more likely to experience use of force by police. And if force is used, it's not clear that Black Americans are more likely to die at the hands of police, given that they have been subject to use of force. But it's very clear, I think, in the research, that Black Americans are more likely to experience use of force and more likely to experience encounters with police. And that has to do with how the police are actually assigned, where they're assigned to work, what they're assigned to do, how they're trained.
Let's bring in another call. Linda is with us from Sheboygan now. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm still worried about Dontre Hamilton, his murderer went free. And I think we should do something about this before the statutes of limitations run out. Dontre Hamilton was a Black man sleeping on a bench in Milwaukee, and a police officer shot him 14 times. And nothing's been done about it.
Linda, thank you. Thank you for the call. Pam Oliver, what about Dontre Hamilton's situation when you look at the broader context of these protests?
So the broader context is that this is extremely common. As I said before, if you look at these cases, you know, I've been studying old cases in the news. The most common outcome is, after everything winds down and winds down and winds down, ultimately very little or nothing is done to the police officer who killed the person. That is the most common thing that happens. And there's a great deal of what's going on in the U.S. Legal system that is actually set up to protect police officers. And many activists believe that is precisely the problem, is that there is no accountability. There is essential impunity that has been created with a whole series of court decisions and legislation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Pam Oliver, who is a professor of sociology at UW-Madison. Pam, I want to shift the focus here just for a moment, because you also watch how journalists cover protests and demonstrations. What are you seeing now? Because we have seen around the country a number of journalists detained and arrested.
Yeah. So I've seen footage of, several incidents of television reporters just standing there talking to a camera, and the police just come up and arrest the person live on the camera. So it's amazing footage. And first of all, what I see going on right now is tremendous debates in the media about trying to capture the narrative. I mentioned earlier that there's some standard narratives that you see in older press coverage of these protests. And right now, people are contesting what the narrative is. Is the narrative police violence and aggressive policing of the protests, or is the narrative that people are looting and we need to have social control? And so at this very moment, you can read articles that are all over the map trying to capture the narrative about how to understand these events. An interesting thing I found in our ongoing research, it's not published yet, it's literally, we're working on it right now, is I found that same, in some of the incidents in the past where I've been looking at old newswire stories, I've actually seen the same newswire on the same day issue stories that have different narratives. One that's more like what you would think of as a pro-police narrative, and another that's a pro-protester narrative coming out of the same news organization on the same day. And so I do think the research tends to say that the news media, news reporters typically have closer relationships with the police than with the protesters. And so the overall research says the news media tend to give a pro-police coverage of these events. But there's at the same time contesting narratives about what people are saying are actually going on. There is a tendency in the United States to get away from what are actually the structural issues that are ultimately the causes of the problem, and to focus on was this individual person right or wrong, or this specific act right or wrong. And it's harder for people in the United States. I'm not just saying just journalists, but everybody in the United States is not very good at trying to pay attention to what are the structures we're operating under, instead of just individual stories.
Well, Pam, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Pam Oliver is a professor emerita of sociology at UW-Madison, where she studies protest movements and racial disparities in criminal justice. Just ahead, Newbery Medal-winning author Aaron Entrada Kelly writes about unexpected friendships, bullies, families, so much more. She joins us to talk about the stories she's written and the ones still in her head. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.